Hi, welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast program. Get inspired, break through to new dimensions with your peers on the entrepreneurial journey of self-discovery, leadership revolution, and life success. Learn something new from our mentoring conversation today. Hey, everybody. It's We Mentor Mondays with Nancy. And guess who's in the house? Carolyn Porter.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, thank you. Yay. She's back for part two of her incredible true story of her journey to create a font and the search for one man's fate. We're taping on Martin Luther Jr. Day, and I wanted all of you to know we need to really take our democracy back. And you can start by listening to David Letterman. He's got a new show on Netflix called My Next Guest Needs No Introduction with David Letterman. And his first guest is past President Barack Obama. Barack Obama and him have this amazing conversation about our democracy, and it's so constructive and productive and very, very inspiring what he's creating in Chicago with the Obama Foundation. They also talk, because it aired just today on Martin Luther King Day, a big inspiration that without Representative John Lewis, who was given the Congressional Medal of Honor for his civil rights activism by past President Barack Obama, he's also featured in this episode because they focused on the march on March 7th, 1965, when there was a group of African Americans and their civil rights leaders who were walking across the Elmond Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. It's a 50-mile march to Montgomery, where they were going to register to vote. What was interesting was the history of how we have discriminated against people and made it the most difficult place in any democracy to vote. Again, we're learning more and more about our history. It was organized walk, so the police really exploited the situation and were very violent. And the president at the time, our president, Mr. Johnson, had ordered that altercation there with the police, between the police and these protest walkers. They weren't doing anything. It was a peaceful walk.
Protest.
Yeah, very much so. And was interesting, a comment from John Lewis was, he said, President Johnson can send over people to fight in Vietnam, but they can't send enough police officers to Selma, Alabama to help them organize a peaceful walk to register to vote. But we started our country out with discrimination because it was first white men with property got to vote. Then it was white men without property got to vote, you know, and then finally, you know, black men got to vote. And then finally women got to vote, or was it reverse? It was all together. Anyways, check out, so on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, the day of this taping, I wanted to honor his legacy, and I also wanted to encourage you to listen to that conversation. We need a lot of hope, and we also, there's lots of ideas of how we can organize ourselves to take charge of our own democracy, and when we see something that isn't right, we're in a time frame right now where we cannot be silent. We need to speak out, and we need to not keep secrets, and we need to not be shamed into silence ever, ever, ever again. So that's my take.
Thank you for that. I need to watch that interview. It sounds fantastic and powerful, and a message we need to hear.
It is, and I was nostalgic, teary-eyed, I listened to it earlier today for President Barack Obama, the most respected president that I've ever seen in office or experienced since I started voting during the Ronald Reagan. He was the first president into office. And I happen to have voted for him. So the last thing I would like to say about this, this isn't about being a Democrat or a Republican. This is about the difference between allowing yourself to support insanity and choosing to be more conscious and speak out against lies and discounting facts. I mean, that's why we're losing our control of our democracy, mm-hmm. is because we're not acknowledging that there are facts that are beyond a person's opinions.
Right.
That we need to follow. And so I had never envisioned that I would be speaking out like this in this way. But we're at a very frightening time, and our democracy is more fragile than all of us, I think, ever imagined it could be.
And constitutional values are not party specific.
Oh, really good point. And we need to get away from, I've been a Republican all my life, or mm-hmm. I've been a Democrat all my life, and this is how mm-hmm. I vote, because character matters.
Right.
Absolutely. Vote on, look at the character of the person and who the administrator, who they're pulling themselves around them. So we've got a lot of work ahead of us. We've got a long history of fighting for what's right. And we can all make a difference in our communities by using our voices and by working together with each other.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome. All right. So in our first episode with Carolyn, she's just a very inspiration. Let me tell you about her book and her journey a little bit. And then we're going to share with you our conversation. We had a little bit of a mishap. So we had taped episode 2, which we were going to air actually last week. But, you know, the first week of the year, but we had a little, a big glitch, really, and we lost the episode. It kind of is in nowhere land.
So all those secrets that we shared about how to make 2018 just the perfect year are gone.
Yeah, gone, gone. So we'll have to, so we're going to have some, so whatever we mentioned, we're going to start again. I'm sure this will be a deeper and richer conversation even because we know each other a little better now.
That's true.
Yeah. And thank you for being so generous in, you know, coming back to the studio and redoing this episode.
Well, taping the first time was a lot of fun, and I know tonight will be as well.
Oh, great. Seeking inspiration for a new font design in an antique store in small-town Stillwater, Minnesota, graphic designer Carolyn Porter stumbled across some old letters and was immediately drawn to the beautifully expressive pen and ink handwriting. She could not read the letters. They were in French, but she noticed they had been signed by a man named Marcel and mailed from Berlin to France during the middle of World War II. As Carolyn grappled with the designing font, she decided to have one of Marcel's letters translated. Reading words of love combined with testimony of survival inside a German labor camp transformed Carolyn's curiosity into an obsession, and she sought to find out why the letter, Marcel Houssay, had been in Berlin, how his letters came to be for sale in a store halfway around the world, and most importantly, whether he returned to his beloved wife and daughters after the war. Marcel's letter is the incredible story of Carolyn's increasingly desperate search to find answers to the mystery of one man's fate, answers that would come from Germany, France, and the United States. Simultaneously, she would continue to work on what would become the acclaimed P22 Marcel script font, immortalizing the man and his letters that waited years to be reunited with his family. It's a beautiful book, like I said in our first episode, and we learned of Carolyn's inspiration to become a graphic designer, kind of started at 4-H.
Right.
Which is
my parents got a kick out of listening to that part of the interview.
Oh, did they? Okay, this is the fun part of having you come back is, you know, you've gotten some feedback from others.
Right.
Oh, that's very sweet. And she, you know, refining letters and making them perfectly round or straight, she had the patience and focus to redraw a line 40 to 60 times to reach the desired level of perfection. That is the way to create a new font. University of Wisconsin Stout formed her understanding of graphic design. A year in London rejuvenated her spirit, so when she returned to Minnesota, she was ready to focus her attention on becoming proficient in her field through the tutelage of Tim Eaton.
Great summary. Yep.
Great. Okay. She met her husband, Aaron, on a blind date. I just love this. This is like also, you know, unique about your story. So Aaron's mother and Carolyn's mother work together, and they set them up on a date. So they seem to have
known something.
I mean,
what's more embarrassing than that, right?
Sorry to bring it up again, but it's 22 years later, you're right. Still married.
Right.
So thank goodness you listened to your mother's. She's been in her venture for 16 years, going on 17. And we finished out our conversation with the innocently started project that would become her obsession to find the Frenchman behind the 1944 World War II letters while creating her new font, P22 Marcel font, and how she became an unlikely author. Okay. So, Carolyn, how are you feeling right now? You sound inspired.
I'm good. You know, it's the beginning of a new year. A lot to work on, a lot to look forward to. I have a whole bunch of events lined up for the book. Some speeches, talking to some book clubs, so some good events lined up.
And you mentioned just before we got on the air that you're in your third printing with your book.
It has been out of stock for about a month. Apparently later this week, it's going to be back in stock.
Okay, so yeah. People can order the book when this airs on the 22nd of January.
Absolutely,
okay.
Absolutely.
Beautiful.
And I think perhaps it has taken the publisher by surprise that people are so interested in reading a book that combines a font and World War II, which are two topics that usually aren't paired together. But I think people are really, the story of hope and tenacity is resonating with people.
Yeah, especially this time. And comedic shows are like skyrocketing. Like Jerry Seinfeld has a new show, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee.
I haven't seen any of those.
Oh my gosh. So it's on Netflix. It's really funny. And I just find when I'm down a little bit, I just, you know, go to comedy because
people need to laugh.
We need to laugh.
Right.
So, and your story is such a beautiful, true story of combining your passion for what you do with uncovering, something very unique that inspired you to investigate and find out more about this mystery around Marcel.
Right. And it turns out that Marcel had been a civilian forced laborer. So he was sent from France to Germany in 1943. And this impacted a relatively small number of people, all people considered that were impacted by the war. So it's a small-ish group of people. So they've largely been forgotten by history. I've talked to people who know quite a bit about World War II and who have never heard about this group of forced civilian laborers. So it was not only uncovering history, but uncovering part of history that not a lot of people have heard about.
Yeah. And we can't say much more about...
we can't give away all the spoilers.
Right, right. The job he was doing and the irony of his experience.
Well, I can say that he was in Berlin. He was working for the Daimler Corporation, and
I didn't want to spoil it.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay.
So he was making tanks. So he was forced to make tanks. So part of what it took a while to really wrap my head around was the fact that as a Frenchman, he was working for a company making tanks that were fighting the people trying to liberate his country and liberate his family. So it was just this no-win situation that he was in.
Right. And to come to terms with that and right. the treatment that he experienced.
And the fact that the French government was complicit in sending their civilians to Germany. So betrayed by his own government in a way.
Yeah. And in 2011 is where your book starts.
Right.
How did you decide that you wanted to write the book?
So you're right. In 2012 is when I had the first letter translated and really began.
2012.
Oh, yeah. Okay. No, what did I say?
I said 2011.
2011 is correct. That's when I had the first letter translated. But in 2012, really when I was just in the depths of the search for information, the story became bigger than me, bigger than the font, bigger than Marcel, and it just felt like the universe was conspiring in ways that I didn't understand. And it felt like this story had to be told. Not that I wanted it to be told. It had to be told. It had to be shared.
I have found that this is how the universe works. When we're on the path to where we've connected with our passion and we've uncovered something, mm-hmm. and we're like a dog on a bone where we can't let go.
Right, right.
And somehow the universe like conspires to help us.
Right.
Like things start coming into place that are like, there's no way.
Right.
And your story is like a perfect example of that because you've wanted to give up
right.
on so many different occasions.
Right, right. And I can tell you this is really the first time that I ever felt that the universe was conspiring in ways that I didn't understand, but it felt like the universe helped me find the right people who were ultimately able to help me put all the puzzle pieces together.
Because you had to check facts,
right?
You needed a transcriber.
Right. I worked with two different translators.
Yeah. Yes, translators, yep.
A genealogy researcher. There was an amazing researcher at Daimler in Germany who helped as well. So there were all these people who played a part in finding answers to Marcel's fate.
And the fact that you didn't think while you were on this journey that you would write a book.
Oh, it was the last thing on my mind.
So you had to like, this is what when you had said that at the book club that we were at Jennifer Nelson's across the street, when there are two groups in Golden Valley of book clubbers, and most of them were graphic designers. Yeah. That it's a surprise to you.
Right, right. So when I finally got permission to write the book, which in itself was a complicated process, it took a long time to recreate this timeline of what happened when and when did I get in touch with certain people or when did I learn certain things. It was basically taking the puzzle apart to then be able to put it back together, which took quite a while, but I wanted to be very authentic to the timeline of the sequence of what I learned.
Yeah. So as you're pulling together all these facts, and resources to try to reconstruct the timeline. How did you put the timeline together?
I knew I wanted the reader to experience what I experienced. So at the beginning, the book begins with the translation of the first letter, which is what happened in mid-2011. And then I knew how I wanted the book to end. Which I won't say here. So it was really then.
Well, and the book doesn't really, I mean, the story still goes on, and you added some other things in the book club that happened after the story, which I think is, we could have you on once more people have read the book
We could have a book club after people read the book.
Yes.
So then it was essentially recreating the timeline of what happened between the translation of the first letter and the ending of the book, and then making choices about the order and the pace and what was in and what was not included. So basically drawing a line from this point to this point and then figuring out what is hanging from this line.
Yeah.
You think of like a clothesline.
Yeah. When I think your attention to detail like fits your skill set with coming up with a new font.
very detail focused. And I'll tell you a story about that. So there's one scene at a restaurant, and because I wanted to be very authentic to all of the details in every part of the book, I wanted to talk about what we ate, right?
Oh, yes.
And
I remember that part. Yeah. Okay.
And I kind of remembered, I knew what I had eaten for dinner, but I couldn't remember for sure what other people had eaten. So it was right when people were starting to take photos of their dinners to, you know, put on Instagram and social media.
All
so
right.
I knew I had photos of the dinner. So I sent the photos to the chef, to the head chef of the restaurant.
Yeah.
And basically said, what is this?
And the fact that the head chef was still there.
Well, he owns the restaurant.
Okay, so good.
Yep, but he was able to say, oh, that is rabbit saddle. So then I was able to include that detail in the book. But to me, it was important because this is a true story to be very authentic to all of those details. So wherever I could, I went back and scoured emails and whatever kind of record I could find for that documentation, whether it be photos or receipts or emails or FedEx delivery slips or whatever.
Yeah. So, and the fact that you stuck with it has really been a very unique skill for an entrepreneur, that they persevere.
Well, that was something that you had said in one of our offline conversations, which I found really interesting, because I have had other people tell me, you know, they just can't believe that I didn't give up, that I just kept on it, that I just became obsessed. But you said something really enlightening, and that was that the fact that when I ran into one dead end, I would figure out another way to try to get the information was just very entrepreneurial. And so it didn't surprise you, since I have my own business, that that's the way entrepreneurs think. If you can't get something done one way, you think creatively and think, how else can I accomplish this goal? So in the search, when I would run into one roadblock, think of a different way to try to get the information. To me, at the time, I wasn't thinking, this is an entrepreneurial skill that I'm applying.
Right.
It was just looking for more information.
Yeah.
So it was just really enlightening when you were commenting on how that is a skill that you see in the entrepreneurs that you coach.
Yeah. Okay. Very wonderful. Yeah. And you certainly have that. And just to muster up all your skill sets and the support of your husband, I mean, that's just a beautiful thing too.
Well, at the beginning, I think he was somewhat ambivalent about the project, because it was my project. It wasn't his project.
Yeah.
But as time went on, as he saw the emotional investment that I was making, I mean, first of all, he was concerned because just I was losing sleep. I would be up at 2 or 3 a.m. just searching for information. And you could see that that was taking a toll. But he could also see Marcel was important. He was a real person. He was a real person writing to his wife and his daughters, and he mattered.
Yeah, and there was an unfinished story there. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I just had to know if Marcel returned to his wife and his daughters.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems so simple, but it was a really complicated time. It was a complicated situation. But
and so much time had passed.
Right.
You know, and that was another thing that was like kind of odd, I thought, with the book. Like, wow. I mean, like all these years and we've never heard about this person, and how did these letters get in, you know, an antique store? Like, how come they didn't get to his wife and daughters? And then you found more letters, you know, so it was, you know, like the story kept unfolding and becoming more and more intriguing. So I can see why you were like, I just can't quit.
Like, could have let it go until I had an answer.
And Aaron knew that about you.
Right. But I think we both believed.
Yeah.
I certainly did, that I'm going to find the answer today. You know, like just very optimistic, like I'm so close to finding the answer. I'm going to find the answer before I go to bed tonight, right?
Yeah, right.
And I mean, it was just week after week and month after month of just believing I was so close to finding an answer and just that answer just being so elusive for so long.
Yeah. And I really felt like I was on the journey with
good,
you.
Good.
Yeah. And like I was feeling the emotions too, like, where is he?
Right. Because so for so long, it just seemed like he was erased from history, just completely gone.
Well, and I think that's what's so beautiful about your story is you brought his family to light and to life in preserving his, I mean, that's when someone passes away, you just are afraid, like, you know, you're going to lose their history and right. memories. And you brought someone, you resurrected someone.
Right. Taking this, his beautiful handwriting from these beautiful letters and just bringing him back to life initially through this font.
Yeah. And because you named this font, Marcel's mm-hmm. font, mm-hmm. What were some of the legal issues? Because this is also part of the entrepreneurial journey.
Right.
You run into legal issues.
Right.
When you're inventing new stuff.
Right. And between the font and the book, I can tell you I've spent a lot of money on lawyers.
Yeah.
But there are different issues with the legalities of the book and the legalities of the font. So basically, you can take anybody's handwriting and digitize it and turn it into a font. There might be a few exceptions, but you don't own what an A looks like. I don't own what an A looks like. All I own is the computer code that defines this specific A.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
You know, you write your name with an A and an N.
Yeah.
And I write my name with an A and an N. Neither of us own those letters. So that is yeah. why
yeah.
I could digitize his handwriting without his permission. You know, at the beginning, I didn't even know who he was.
Yeah.
Writing the book, however, had a completely different set of legal issues. And it did ultimately take a year to get all of the permissions that I needed to be able to write the book.
Again, you stuck with it. Didn't matter. What mattered was you needed to get this out there in the world.
The story had to be told.
Yeah. Yeah. And you were the one. You were the one.
I guess.
Yeah. And people,
I mean, I just feel like this story, in a way, came to me. So then it was my responsibility to tell it.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. I feel like it's channeled through you.
And I have talked to other people or have listened to other people speak about feeling the same kind of responsibility. In those cases, those have all been family stories, also family war stories, where they feel this tremendous responsibility to tell the story of their grandfather or their uncle or whomever. But it's just this, they describe the same responsibility that just resides inside of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I will include in the show notes where people can, you can actually pay to have the set of fonts, P22,
oh, yeah. Thank
Marcel's
you.
Font.
Yep.
Yeah, we'll
Thank
have
you.
That in the show notes. So people, if you would like to try out her font, you can do that. You can actually purchase it, which I didn't know. You know, I just thought all those fonts just, you know, that we have choices of, that right. there weren't more than that.
And I hear that quite often from people who don't work with fonts. I mean, I come from the world of graphic design, so I work with fonts all the time.
Yeah.
But I've talked to many people who had no idea that they could license and use and customize fonts, and that there are many, many thousands of fonts to choose from.
Yeah.
Oh, that all have their story. They all have a designer behind them.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is where, you know, that entrepreneurial spirit is so fantastic, you know, for people to go in and use, the longer you're in something, you have like a laser beam focus
right.
of what works in the field, what doesn't. And then all there's the opportunities there to make things better.
Right. And that, in this world of typography, there's a whole group of people that design fonts.
Yeah. And how did you muster up like I can see myself in writing being super critical, you know, like when I first started the podcast too, and on occasions, you know, I'm still kind of hypercritical, but that's also an opportunity to learn. And I like feedback from people and I take that in and do something with it. But I was thinking with writing, it's a lot different. For some reason, I just feel it's more solitary. And you have to, you don't know exactly who to give it to like proofread. How did you get your contract to get published? How did you figure out all that? Because that took a lot of research too.
It is a huge learning curve, and it is a whole world that I knew nothing about. So I initially tried doing a lot of research online, you know, Googling, how do you publish a book? I ended up working with a book development editor, Swenson Book Development, who really helped me find my way through this forest of publishing that I had no idea how to get through.
Yeah.
So everything from writing a book proposal to just finalizing the arc of the story and then some editing. And then she helped me get an agent. The agent helped me get the publisher in New York. So it's a multi-step process that involves many people.
And how many, like how much did you have developed of the book? Like, did you have the first chapter done or?
When I started working with the book development editor, I had the first 10 of 12 chapters written. And the last two chapters were mapped out, but not finalized.
You mapped them out.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And so they were well on their way. And when I say 12 chapters, for anybody who has read the book, they'll see that it's not in that chapter format anymore. But at one point I heard that publishers like this, you know, magical 12 chapter formula. So I was trying to fit it into that to be able to sell the book to a publisher.
Yeah.
But ultimately that 12 chapter is very transparent. You would never be able to like figure out where those chapters, that's just not the structure of the book in the end.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, the
right.
way you laid it out as far as the dates
right.
and locations of where you were, I think was very helpful.
Good, good. But to be able to package it, to sell it to an agent, to then be able to sell it to a publisher, I was trying to follow this more formulaic structure.
Yeah.
So again, it was mostly written by the time I worked with a book development editor. I had a full draft of the book proposal, but it needed some polishing. But I had never done one before. I had never seen one before, so I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
The book development editor was a great help there.
Did they tell you what percentage of a person who's like written their first book and actually gets it published by a New York publisher, what the percentages of people actually, authors, being able to do that?
Oh, I have no idea.
Yeah, it's probably pretty doggone small.
So. Well, and the whole world of publishing it has changed so much in the previous years, and it just continues to change. And so part of this, you know, wandering through this forest that I didn't understand and not having a map to get through this forest, it's like the forest keeps on changing as you're trying to walk
right,
through. So
right.
That's why for me, it was really helpful to have this book development editor that could just escort me through this process.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. All right. Well, we've got a little more to talk about. You up for it?
Absolutely.
Okay, terrific. So everybody, we're going to close out for now. We'll be back for part three of this fantastic, incredible story with Carolyn Porter about Marcel's letters and her dual process of developing a font along with uncovering the mystery of a Frenchman's life. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks, Carolyn. Thanks, Mike Cabea. Oh, I got to get the phone. All right, get the phone. All right, see you guys next week.